Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight's topic is the Dylan Redwine case and the Haley Dunn case. I'm Kim Colton, Director of Research for CrimeWire, and I'll be manning the switchboard and monitoring the chat room. And now let me introduce the host of tonight's show, statement analyst and CrimeWire consultant, Peter Hyatt. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm in the middle of a snowstorm with a cold, so I'm doing just great myself.
Yes.
We're getting hit again with a early spring, late winter snowstorm, but it's nice.
Yeah. It'll be over soon.
We have a lot of news tonight.
Yes, we do.
We'll begin with a update on the Dylan Redwine case. If you're first joining us now, Dylan Redwine went missing right before Thanksgiving of 2012 when he went on a court-ordered visitation with his father, Mark Redwine. And as most listeners are familiar with, Elaine Redwine, Dylan's mother, went on the Dr. Phil show and confronted Mark Redwine in what I consider a very brave move with her son, Corey, and challenged Mark on national television. Dr. Phil also challenged him, in particular, to take a polygraph. Mark's response was, "We're going to take it. We're going to do it." I think most listeners heard the pronoun "we" and said, "Nope, he's not going to do that." And he did not do it. We saw a highlighted example of his method of deception in which he literally picks and chooses which words he's going to use that someone says to respond to. It's something that's learned in childhood, and he's well rehearsed on it and practiced on it. And the polygrapher on the Dr. Phil show found it maddening, very frustrating. This week, as an update, Elaine Redwine went on a radio program, another program, which I commend her for doing because she's keeping Dylan's name out there. She revealed to the audience that not only had Mark Redwine been found pictures of him wearing women's clothing, but wearing a diaper and eating human feces. And this, of course, is shocking news. The pictures were apparently at the studio for Dr. Phil to use. He was aware of them. He did not use them. In discussions, analyst Karen Goff had taken, I think, a very generous view, and she said that perhaps Dr. Phil was told by law enforcement, please don't use those. There may be a motive involved. But it certainly raised a lot of questions, and it looks like it explains the sensitivity indicators surrounding some of Elaine's statements about sending Dylan and not being worried. I've been involved in many, many cases of in court like this, in child protective cases, and mothers are naturally in denial of any fears of sending their child. However, in this case, it's indefensible. I've been with different judges and who have just hold a wide variance of opinions on child safety. I don't know of a single judge anywhere, and I can't imagine a judge anywhere who would not have stopped that visitation had this been revealed. And so that failure to protect, obviously, is something that is serious and is on the minds of everyone as they listen to it. And we had also heard that Dylan may have confronted his father just a few months before going out there. And given what we know about Mark Redwine's abusive personality, the abuse control type, where rarely does he need to get violent because the threat of violence is what controls people, he has been uncovered, unmasked, stripped bare. He has no supporters left. Even those that would have supported him out of pity from the Dr. Phil show would be so reviled by the disclosure of him wearing a diaper and eating his own feces, that there'll be no support anywhere for him. And so I think it's at a point of desperation. What I'm concerned about, and I'll put this profile up later on tonight, is that Mark Redwine might commit suicide and take with him the secret location of Dylan's grave, which would further punish Elaine. So I hope that with this revelation that law enforcement is moving as quickly as they can to put pressure on Mark Redwine before something like this happens.
What an unbelievable story.
Yeah. And Kim, you had said that you had been offline for a couple of days, and I almost asked you to pull your car over to the side of the road before I told you, because I was concerned about your reaction. It's just that, is that vile, that disgusting?
Yeah, it is.
So that is the latest we have on the Dylan Redwine case, and we were going to cover that more extensively tonight, but some recent developments in the Haley Dunn case, or at least possible developments in the Haley Dunn case, have come to light this week. A body was found on Saturday in Scurry County off a lake in what may have been a makeshift grave that may have been exposed by the elements or by rain, that sort of thing. We don't know if the body is Haley's. As many of you remember, last year we went through the same thing. Several locals last year had said they believed it was Haley. They described what they thought was of certain her. It wasn't. But the question is, at this point, is how many missing dead bodies are going to be found in that rural area that can't be identified? So the odds that it is Haley are obviously going to be increased from last year. Listeners may remember that, and this is going back, I think, possibly January, February of 2012, where we had done analysis on Sean Atkins' words. He had told police that Haley could be found in Scurry County, and I had reported the same thing to law enforcement. That is where you'll find her. He's telling the truth. And he's telling the truth from various reasons. And it's not simply just that he's taunting law enforcement, but we'll get a little bit of that later on. But his words show no deception in that type of statement. And I believe that her remains are in Scurry County. Whether this is her or not, I don't know. We should know relatively soon. From that point, Billie Jean Dunn has continued with her small little world of followers, of supporters, where she continues with her own deception about having her own FBI guy, and she had her own private investigator, and she has this and she has that, that sort of thing. And she's attempting to lead people to believe that the FBI is in contact with her. They're not. They're not. She and Sean Atkins are the prime suspects. And so what I'd like to do is, we have a special guest with us tonight. Mac Sanford is with us, and Mac, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Welcome,
well,
Mac.
Thank you, and thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Kim has a little bit of a bio blurb for you.
Yeah. Let me just read this. So before I do, I want to say that Heather is with us. She's on the line.
Heather from Canada?
Here I am. I'm just lurking in the background, waiting for someone to say my name here, and I'll pop in with anything relevant that comes up.
Okay, well, let us go on to Mac. And Mac Sanford is a licensed private investigator and process server in the state of Texas. He has worked in this capacity for 16 years and specializes in the location of hidden assets, recovery of assets, and missing persons. Mac's support from his family-owned business, the Shiloh Indoor Shooting Range in Houston, Texas, allows him the means to take all cases pertaining to missing children completely pro bono, and with no cost to the families of the missing. Mac is one of the hosts of a weekly radio show on AM 700 KSEV in Houston called Guns Over Texas. And he volunteers extensively for such organizations as the Laura Recovery Center for Missing Children, NCMEC, and the Aid to Victims of Domestic Abuse. He has been involved in many high-profile cases and is currently focusing extensively on the Ali Lowitzer case out of Spring, Texas. Welcome, Mac.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to start off with just a kind of a preliminary view of the case and then we'll move on to questions for Mac. There are a lot of people that have questions for him. First of all, we're looking at Billy Dunn's method of deception. And when we're looking at someone who has the type of deception that she has, we're looking at skills that were learned in childhood. Mark Redwine's method of deception I mentioned before was to pick and choose which words he would like to respond to, which questions he'd like to respond to, which words he will pick up on. Billy Dunn's method of deception is a little bit different. Her method of deception, similar to Casey Anthony, is to give extra words. And so what she'll do is she's a persuasive type of liar. She will use many words thinking that she's actually persuading someone when, in fact, she's unveiling her own need to deceive with the extra wording. So when she's talking about a polygraph, she suddenly, while her child was missing on the Nancy Grace show, talked about having a toothache and she needed pain medicine and antibiotics. Not many people would care about mentioning antibiotics while their child was missing, the 13-year-old child was missing, but in her cases, we'll see in her words, it revealed to us a need to persuade and the fact that she had tried to fool the polygraph itself. So what had happened was Haley Dunn had gone missing at the end of December, and about 2 weeks later, in that January, she went on the Nancy Grace show. And listeners are familiar with this. These two questions highlight her method of deception, and these two questions are being used in trainings around the country and in Canada for training analytical interviewing, deception detection, interviewing techniques, that sort of thing. So on the Nancy Grace show, if listeners could come back with me to the start of this, we have a mother of a missing 13-year-old, and we know nothing about the case. We're going into it cold. And television interviewers don't generally ask good open-ended questions. They like to speak a lot because it brings the focus upon them. In this particular case, it was no different. Nancy Grace was recounting the case. She mentioned that it sounded very much like a case from that was found on the CNN library, crime library, that Billy had downloaded and printed out. But she asked the mother of the missing 13-year-old, how far did she have to go? And instead of asking what happened, which would be the best question to ask and allow her to start the account where she wants to, she said, how far does she have to go? And here we see right off the bat, from the very beginning of this case, Billie Jean Dunn's method of deception. She said 4 to 5 blocks. And that is a good answer. And she should have stopped there. But she didn't. She said, it wasn't rare for Haley to walk a short distance during daylight. She wasn't allowed to go out after dark, especially to walk, but she only had 4 to 5 blocks to go. So what we find there in the answer is that she first does answer the question, 4 to 5 blocks, and should have stopped there. This is why attorneys do not let their clients go on television without them present. But what she went from there was she referenced Haley in the past tense. Big mistake. And she attempted to portray herself as a really caring mom, which is a hot signal that she's worried about her reputation even while her 13-year-old is missing. When a mother of a missing child references, and it's a slip of language, in the past tense, the child, the first thing we look at is context. Have police told her anything that would lead her to believe that her child was dead? Has there been circumstances? Has been blood been found? Something that would rob the natural denial of a mother. This is going back to the wisdom of Solomon. And in this particular case, police were actually looking at possible runaway in the beginning, that she may have run away. So as far as we knew, there was nothing to indicate that she didn't have anything but hope. So this is a possible indication of guilty knowledge that Haley is dead. So we are on high alert. Mm-hmm. Then this Nancy Grace said, tell me what happened on the day she went missing. And this is really the best question to ask because it allows her to start, because we don't know what time she went missing, it allows the subject to start where the subject chooses to begin her story. And her answer is key. She said, she went missing on Monday while I was at work. The first thing she wants us to know is that she has an alibi. She pinpoints a time frame of when she went missing, even though she really did. Technically, she wouldn't have known by the story, but it's important for her to let us know while she was at work. So right off the bat, in the first 5 minutes of her appearance on the Nancy Grace show, going back 2 years ago, whatever it was, is that A, Haley is dead, and B, I, Billie Jean Dunn, need an alibi. And the deception went on from there. From there, as the story was progressing, what we were doing, Heather and I together, we were posting analysis each night because each day, Billie Jean Dunn and Sean Atkins were on television or radio. And at one point, some of the Texas Rangers said, we're reading your analysis every morning, and you know more about the case than some of the investigators may know about it. It's amazing. And all we were doing was simply listening to their words. We did not know, for instance, that there was child pornography in the house, but Heather had picked up and keyed in on the word look. So Billie Jean might have been reading the crime stories that she downloaded, but Sean Atkins was looking at those things. And we said this is usually a word that's more associated with pornography. From there it went to drugs, child pornography, bestiality, drug abuse, failed polygraphs, and a mountain of circumstantial evidence that just caved in to the point where even Nancy Grace was picking up on it, including the party on New Year's Eve. So it just became this pylon. From there, I had interviewed on the phone Clint Dunn, Haley's father, who had really quite a tumultuous relationship with Billie Jean Dunn, where he feared her. He feared her, and he feared that she and Sean had done something and were lying, and he had gone over there to search, and he found that Billie Jean Dunn would not get off the couch. She was watching her favorite soap opera, and she wasn't going to budge, and her son David was sitting before the television, and he was playing video games. I am a father of 4 sons. 3 of them are grown now. I cannot picture for the life of me any one of them sitting and having the presence of mind to play a video game while their teenage sister was missing. And neither did Clint Dunn find a way to rectify this in his own mind. And so he had revealed quite a bit of information about the violent relationship, the propensity for violence from Sean Atkins. He feared Sean Atkins. The family feared Sean Atkins. He had threatened Haley and Billie Jean Dunn with violence. And each time, Billie Jean would have an answer for these things, yet she would go too far and give us extra information. And we have a principle in analysis. When someone gives us an extra word, a word that the sentence can still work without, we have an abundance of information. Time has passed. Billie Jean had at different times floated the idea that she and Sean had broken up, yet she would use the pronoun we, and then they'd find out they were at the no-tell motel together. And the saga went on and on, but we never had an arrest, and this was shocking. She had John Young, an attorney who had a reputation for narcissism, where he just would take any case that would bring him attention. He made an attempt to call me out on televised news. He said something about what kind of fool would say these things. He's going to bring me to court to Texas justice and sue me and that sort of thing. And then, as he called me a fool, he was then arrested, reportedly under the influence of cocaine, pointing a 9mm at a Texas Ranger. So his definition of fool in his internal subjective personal dictionary would be interesting to learn. But even that went along the wayside as he was able to get himself again out of trouble and back to practicing law again. He was the one that was famous for saying our girl and our daughter, that sort of silly language, putting himself in the case. Then we come to the point where we introduce Mac. We had heard, at first it was floated around out there and people would email me or contact me through Facebook and say, Billie Jean Dunn has hired her own private investigator. And I at first chuckled about it because I wondered where the money came from. I had known that from Clint that she purchased cocaine for the purpose of resale, literally inviting this type of danger into her home. But I had said at the time, and I think some of the listeners will remember this, that if the investigator is anything worth his salt, he will come to the truth and we'll let that play out as it would. There was a great deal of controversy that surrounded this. I didn't get involved in it. I was kind of grateful. And lo and behold, I received a message from someone this morning in Facebook named Max Sanford, who said he'd like to contact me. And I was very glad to hear from you, Mac, and I appreciate you reaching out on this case. We don't know each other yet, and this is the first time we're talking, and today was the first time we've communicated. But I think you probably have a lot of interesting information that listeners would like to hear. So welcome, and thank you for being on the program tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And what you were saying about the you know, Texas Rangers, you know, look, checking your statement analysis, you know, every day, is more than true, and not just on their part, but on mine as well. When I first when I got involved in the case and actually started researching the actual case and researching the players and not just looking for the girl, I became a huge fan of yours, and you know, and I was glued to the statement analysis. They proved time and time again to be, you know, pretty spot on. There was there's a number of things. I don't even really know where to jump in and start. There's a couple of things.
How about I ask you some questions? If that'd be okay.
Yeah, certainly.
Did you know about the case before you were approached?
I did. I had, you know, I follow the missing children cases pretty closely. It's about 8 hours away from where I reside, from where I live in Texas. I typically concentrate on the ones in my area, Southeast Texas, and so those I'm really familiar with. This one, I've known it was a Texas girl. When I'm contacted by a parent, you know, I handle missing children cases pro bono, completely pro bono. And so in the majority of them usually turn out to be, you know, a runaway. They turn out to be, you know, a troubled teen. Parents find marijuana in their underwear drawer, and they, you know, they run away for 3 days and come home. You know, but, you know, those are the majority of the cases. And even regardless if it's one of those, you know, we have to handle the case with an incredible sense of urgency. Because they're still minors, they're still out there. We don't know, you know, who's protecting them, if they're being protected. So there's still an incredible sense of urgency to find that child. So when I was contacted by Billy Dunn originally, it was, "Hi, I'm Billy Dunn. I have a, you know, missing daughter, Haley. She's been gone for a year, you know, or 2 years at that point. Can you help me?" And of course, immediately, I just, "Yes, absolutely. Let's go find Haley." You know, I took the case and got involved, not really researching at all before I jumped in with both feet, not realizing who I was, you know, what the circumstances behind the disappearance were or anything like that. I had originally taken the case to try to find the girl, you know, not try to prove who did it, but to, you know, try to locate, you know, a missing teenager.
What were the first steps you took in after you took the case? Actually, back if I could a second, how did she contact you?
She called me. She had received my number. Apparently, I found it off of the Allie Lotzer case. I'd been working on the Allie Lotzer case since April of 2010 and had, you know, gotten a lot of press on that. And she didn't, you know, my number's pretty easy to find. And she, you know, she just called me out of the blue. She was referred. There's a number of people, as you probably know, that around the country, it's kind of a social phenomenon, in my opinion, but they don't really have anything to do with the people involved, but they find themselves completely drawn to the case, and they engulf themselves, they immerse themselves in it. So, you know, you have, you know, a housewife in St. Louis, a truck driver in Pennsylvania, you know, that don't have anything to do with any of the cases, but, man, they know every solitary detail of these missing people, you know, missing children cases. And they go online, and they have several profiles, and they know every in minutia of the cases. They know the details. And,
Mac, if I could comment on that a bit, the that phenomenon, I saw it increase with JonBenet Ramsey case, where people looked at a picture, they saw a little girl's face, and they just wanted to see her safe. But the internet has increase the flow of information like crazy. And I think that law enforcement is where we find law enforcement actively listening to the St. Louis housewife, for instance. I find that to be a lot of wisdom in that. You know, of course, there can be tangents, but there are people out there that are able to put together two and two better than some others at times and able to contribute. So I have a certain respect for those that keep an open mind, because the country, I think, overall is losing confidence in law enforcement. Even as grades go down and one FBI scandal after the next, and there are so many cases that have gone unresolved, in which people are looking at the cases with all the information saying, we know who done it. This is not a mystery. Where is the arrest? The Baby Lisa case, where the FBI shared information, according to Joe Tacopina, shared information with him against Deborah Bradley, yet no arrest. And that stunned me. As much as anyone sees, there's more scandals actually in today's news, where you know this FBI agent or that FBI agent is now dating a drug dealer or something, it's upsetting. And the educational standards are lower. I know that a lot of folks go to the private sector, the talent goes where there's more money, but there are a lot of people that are pretty smart out there that are putting pieces of a puzzle together and scratching their heads going, why no arrest here? But let me stay on course with this. What were the first steps you took after Billie Jean Dunn got in touch with you?
Well, the first thing I did was schedule a meeting with Billie, and she had moved to Austin, which is roughly 4 hours from Colorado City, where Haley went missing. I'd gone up to Austin and had explained to her, you know, I'm not here to determine guilt, to determine who did it. We're just, you know, we're taking this case in the capacity of locating and finding a missing 13-year-old girl who at the time, you know, was nearly 15. So, that's where we went into it. So I went and had an extensive interview with her, probably, I'd say, 6 to 8 hours. I sat in her apartment.
Wow.
And just asked every imaginable question. Got a list of basically every person she'd ever been in contact with, every one of her friends. One thing real fast, I want to add this before I forget, I want on the record, okay, I'm pretty vocal about the way that missing children are handled by law enforcement, especially, I don't know, in other states. I've never, you know, I don't have much experience in working in other states, but here, you'll have 4 or 5 enforcement agencies, law enforcement agencies, on the same case. And nobody, you know, it becomes a big, you know, imagine nobody wants to share information with each other. And if they do, it's not properly documented. You know, the local the city PD has got information the sheriff's department doesn't have, and the sheriff's department's looking into the case, and the feds are rumored to be around, and pretty soon, you know, then you have the constables that you know are also reviewing the case in their runaway department, and it's a nightmare. There's no set, you know, the child's missing, boom, let's go. Here's a plan of action. This agency takes over. You know, when there needs to be that. And that was one of the major reasons why, this whole case from the beginning was so absolutely askew. It had so many questions and open-ended, you know, it was under such public scrutiny of, you know, mistakes from certain law enforcement and mistakes from this. Well, I was the most vocal one against law enforcement at first, and I made an absolute ass out of myself going out and, you know, just decrying all the mistakes that law enforcement made. Well, I got to tell you, to their credit, okay, to the Colorado City Police Department credit, their investigator is a woman named Kelsey Alexander, and she has absolutely 1,000,000% redeemed herself in my eyes. I had the occasion to actually go meet her face-to-face. This is after, of course, I was in the media just slamming law enforcement, but I didn't slam them as hard as the media made it out to sound. You know, that makes any sense. There was a lot of splicing and cutting and pasting of the things that I had said of my statements that made my opinion of the law, of law enforcement, how they handled the case, a lot more brutal and you know than it actually was. So needless to say, I was not a very popular guy amongst the law enforcement community. Well,
okay, she was the one that wrote the affidavit, is that correct?
Yes, she originally was the one responding officer, you know, when she was first reported, she's the one that took over from there. When I went and met her, you know, I met her face-to-face in the Colorado City Police Department, and she was dressed in her BDUs, you know, active on-duty attire, not investigator gear, not undercover or anything, just, you know. And she told me, you know, she said, and I've never heard this kind of honesty from a law enforcement agent before, but she told me, she said, you know what? She said, I spent the first 4 hours of my day. You want to guess how I spent it? And I said, I have no idea. Writing tickets? And she said, no. Three pigs escaped from a farmer on the outskirts of town, and I spent the first 4 hours of my day rounding up those pigs and putting them back. And she said, so I never had handled a missing child case before. She said, that's the kind of stuff I deal with. And so she goes, I made my mistakes. I made several mistakes, of course, because I've never dealt with this before. And at that point, she really earned me, you know, I really earned a lot of respect for her because she really owned up to it. And she really, you know, turned out she had a serious emotional involvement in the case. And she, you know, she didn't want to see any ill will. You know, she wanted to find the girl and bring her home. So you know, I mean, I wanted to get that out clear that I had, you know, I had slammed her pretty good from the beginning. But then when I actually met her, she turned out, you know, she owned up and, you know, was very humble. And I just respect the heck out of her for that.
Well, right, I'm going to have to keep you on track here, Mac. Now, was
this
the time
that
you?
I'll be there.
That's okay. Was this at the time you were sleeping with Billie Jean Dunn? This
great.
Was one of the rumors that Mac had to face that he wanted to address as well, because we're out there now. Mac, it was it's not something I had heard, but it was until today actually. But people had accused you of bonding with Billie Jean Dunn, of partying with Billie Jean Dunn, with sleeping with Billie. How do you speak to that?
Well, I spent an ample amount of time with her, and I was her biggest supporter, you know, after going in there and trying to, you know, getting a course of action to, you know, going back to, you know, where we started, you know, where we started from. I made the list of suspects and, you know, of what happened, you know, and we started going from there. I never slept with her. I never as much as hugged her. There was a couple nights that I'd driven out to Austin, which is about 3 hours, 2.5 hours from Houston, where I live. And I ended up staying at her apartment, but, you know, I slept on the couch. There's no physical contact. There's nothing. I mean, it was completely, you know, there was nothing behind it. Well, of course, the rumors were flying because the more I got to, got her side, the more stories I heard, and the more she talked about the case, the more, you know, placing blame on possible others, and you know, it became I made the mistake of forming feeling like almost like I was forming an alliance with her rather than.
I wanted to ask you about that, those words, because I you know, I think you've denied the romantic involvement, and people can hear your denial that way, but. You interviewed her the first time, you said it was somewhere between 6 and 8 hours.
Yes.
When that was complete, what was your opinion of her and of the case?
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing I noticed, and I don't know, this, hopefully this makes sense to you, especially the people that are listening, but the first thing I noticed is that you have an allegedly grieving mother with a child missing for 2 years who's dead set on the hope that she's still alive and the hope to bring her home, okay? And she's doting on the hope that she's holding on to bring her home. And, yes, I know we will bring her home. But at the same time, she moved 4 hours away from the only home that Haley had known into a two-bedroom apartment with her then, you know, adult-age son. So if you're going to bring your daughter home, wouldn't you have at least have moved into a three-bedroom apartment and set up a third bedroom with all of her stuff?
Did you think in that 8 hours or 6 hours, whatever it was, did you think that she was truthful or deceptive?
I really did, but there was a lot of indicators that were throwing me off, and I have a tendency to you know think with my heart and not my brain, I'm still looking at her as a grieving mother, a mother who's missing her child, and let's find the kid. You know, that's what the main goal was. You know, regardless of who did it, let's find the child. Well, you know, let's at that point you can't make promises to parents. You can't say, hey, I'm going to bring your kid home, or we're going to bring her home. You know, you can't propagate that. So at that point it was really difficult because, you know, she was sending out some indicators, a gut feeling. Kim, is that her name? Your host? One of your hosts?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Kim. Yeah, Kim had put it pretty clearly. I mean, that the hairs on the back of your neck kind of stood up in a way, you know, kind of indicating that there was just a weird presence there, that something's off, something's not right. But, you know, at that point, I was overlooking it because, you know, our objective was to find the child. You know, not figure out who did it yet. Let's find the kid.
Mm-hmm.
I overlooked a lot of it. You know, because for that reason.
When did you begin
to
maybe change from supporter to questioner?
Well, I'll tell you the exact moment was I was going through some witness statements that the original police department had taken, and the thing that got me, that struck me, is the point where Sean Adkins's statement was that he had quit. He had gone into work and gotten into an argument with the boss and quit that morning, the morning that she disappeared. But I found a witness statement that said of a coworker of his that had said that he was in the parking lot at the same time Adkins pulled in. Adkins pulled in that morning at, you know, roughly, I forgot the time. I haven't looked at the details of this case in quite a while, so I'm you know, guesstimating the time here. But 5:45 a.m., 6 a.m. He said he left the car running, went inside with his coveralls, came back without his coveralls a few minutes later, and drove off. And what struck me was, is that, okay, I looked back at the temperature that day, and the temperature that day was like 34 degrees, 35 degrees. And so why would somebody leave their car running? He stated he went into work, but then got into a fight with the supervisor and quit. Well, if he got to work not intending to quit, why would he leave his car running? Well, because it was 35 degrees and there was somebody in the car with him. That's why. You know, and he left the heater on the car. So at that point, it all started to kind of fall together, the whole theory that together they had driven around the back roads of Dunn and Snyder, Texas, and, you know, that whole previous night trying to allegedly get rid of the evidence, get rid of the body or whatever they were doing out there. They had phone pings to support all that. Law enforcement did to support where they
is that the point where you turned around, you think?
Yeah, that's the exact point. That's the exact, and then, you know, I always had that feeling in the back of my head about the two bedroom apartment, and then that's the thing that really switched me over to, okay, I gotta distance myself from this case because we're no longer
I want to keep you focused on some of the questions because I'm cognizant of the time moving pretty quickly, and I know people have a lot of questions. Would you say that I was the president of or Billie Jean was the president of the Peter Hyatt fan club? Be fair to say?
Maybe the Peter Hyatt, you know, light him on fire and watch him burn fan club, maybe. But, yeah, no, she was, she's not a fan of Peter Hyatt, that's for sure. Your name came up immediately on our first interview when she was giving me a list of names and a list of people online that were especially giving her a hard time that she wanted to really look into because, they're possibly the ones that had something to do with this. And,
right.
What
did you think about the fact that she was giving you the names of people that were bothering her
as opposed to people that would be helping you find Haley. Did that speak to you?
It right away, immediately. It's funny. Yes, absolutely. There is an impending sense of I and me. On all the interviews, you know, every time I talked to her, there was always well, here's what we're doing today to find Haley. It's, well, I'm doing okay today. Some days are better than others for me.
Did you make of the results of their polygraphs?
Well, that's a very interesting point, because she told me originally that the polygraphs were dismissed because they were improperly read by an unlicensed and untrained polygraph examiner, in that they had asked her certain questions 5 and 6 times that had nothing to do with and she stated the way that they'd asked the questions was very suspect and very leading. I forgot some of the examples she'd used, but she, you know, for instance, one of them, I think, was she said, they asked her, do you know where the body is? And she repeatedly said, no. Well, then according to her, she was saying that question should have been invalid because that's insinuating that they know that she murdered the kid, that she murdered the child. By saying that there is a body in the beginning, you know, not saying you know where Haley is, you know where the body is. That's what she
sure,
kept
sure. So, well, it's kind of part of it, part and parcel for her method of displeasure, of not only of deception, but her sociopathic narcissism, where she only focuses on herself and unable to empathize with others. This was something interesting, and people have asked about this, is Billy Dunn had a reputation for sexual immorality. She was a stripper. She's a 40-year-old that tries to dress like an inappropriate 15-year-old, and I apologize to 15-year-olds for saying that. Did you find that sort of behavior when you were with her? You mentioned something about being at a club with her one time.
Yeah, yes and no. There was no, and let me just tell you, I'm not a saint. I mean, I'm sure there's many people out there listening saying, yeah, who am I? Who is he to make a conclusion on that issue? But there was a time when I had taken them, Billy and had some friends, and they wanted to go out on a weekend, and they asked me to go along in a sort of a bodyguard capacity. There was a host of media out there looking for her, constantly following her. There was several very cryptic and then some very detailed threats to her. So, you know, of course, I agreed to go. I went completely in a bodyguard capacity. Didn't consume any alcohol whatsoever. Basically just kind of kept an eye on them, made sure that there weren't any attacks or any stalkers, or if there were, I could de-escalate the situation or whatever it entailed. And so I had walked across the dance floor to go to the bathroom, and she and her friend had stopped me and said, hey, you got to dance with us. And I said, no, not tonight. I'm going to go to the restroom. So she kind of threw a leg up on me and started kind of dancing, on the dance. Then I just kind of stood there and kind of did the left foot, right foot shuffle for a couple seconds and said, okay, I got to go to the bathroom. So I left, I went to the bathroom. Well, apparently at that exact time, somebody had taken a picture, and the ensuing headline, and I forgot where that appeared. It was some small town newspaper in that local area, but the headline was something to the effect of POI seen partying with PI. And, POI meaning person of interest. And this happened about the exact same time that Casey Anthony, it came to light that Casey Anthony had been sleeping with her PI. So it put me in a very precarious position. That's when when the Facebook pages lit up with the, the, you know, I'm sleeping with her for payment, you know, that's why I'm doing it pro bono, because I'm, you know, I'm trying to hook up with this, with her, and it just, it could have been taken more out of context at the wrong time.
Okay, that kind of clears it up, though. How about this? Did you interview Sean Atkins?
No, I didn't. Atkins made him, was very adamantly against letting me talk to him. I had made several attempts. I had sent several messages to him. He was adamant about not talking to anybody, especially me. I found that very suspect because at one point I went on a Blog Talk radio show and actually defended him and said, and that was more on my part. That was more of a strategy, but that ended up not panning out exactly the way I wanted.
You didn't interview him then. I get you, Mac. We have drug use. We have a pretty bold deception. We have a violent person, a history of violence. We have the child porn, the homemade porn. We have a perfect storm of all these things coming together. When you were criticizing law enforcement, in light of all those things, including the affidavit that was public, did you get a sense of how law enforcement viewed you?
I didn't think that they even knew I was on the radar at that point. And if they did, typically law enforcement doesn't typically give that much credit or kudos to a private investigator.
When you were criticizing them, did you get a sense of what they thought of you?
No, honestly, didn't, because I didn't. At that point, I didn't even try. We had so many agencies involved. I didn't even attempt to try to interview any of them or to get any information from them. Mainly because it was at that point was starting to be that's when the buzz started about the FBI coming in and taking over. And ultimately, the FBI did come in and take over an agent named Sean Means, who's in charge of the investigation now. All of the agencies involved were ordered to surrender all their evidence and information to him. And then it was finally, after 2 years, consolidated into one investigation. I tried to contact him, and I actually spoke to him on the phone briefly a couple times and had told him, what I had, and it didn't seem like anything that he already didn't know.
That's fair. But they didn't give you, you didn't have an opinion where they think that, wow, this guy is really smart or this guy's really dumber than dirt, that sort of thing?
No, no, not at all.
Okay.
I didn't get any
next question
at all.
For you. I got to keep you moving. Do you think happened to Haley?
I have my suspicions, and there's so many, and I changed my idea of what happened to her twice, and there were two pretty vastly different circumstances. But I think actually that Haley was killed the night prior to the day she was reported missing. I'm suspecting around between 8 and 10 p.m. the night before. I don't exactly know. I just have a gut feeling on some of the circumstances, but there's a lot of things that led me to believe that she was killed then and then was driven around looking for a dump site. I also think personally that where they found her is not the original dump site. I think I keep saying her. If this body in Scurry County turns out to be Haley, I don't know anything other than, I'm assuming it is at this point when I talk about it. I'm not, I don't know any inside information anymore. I've been way off the case. But if this turns out to be Haley, I don't think that this is the place where they dumped her. I think that originally they dumped her one place and then moved her somewhere else.
Who is they?
Atkins and Dunn. Atkins and Billy Dunn. I don't think Billy knew. I think Atkins moved the body after the first time, and so I honestly don't think that Billy knew where the body was. And I think that's why she could pass that question on a lie detector if they asked her.
Does Billy Dunn know that you believe that she was involved in the death of her daughter?
I don't think so. I had a pretty abrupt cease of contact with her.
How did it end?
Well, the only stipulation that I asked for when I took the case was that, considering there were so many agencies involved, my only stipulation is that I had to, in order to consolidate, I had to be in charge of the independent investigation. I wouldn't work with any other PI. I wouldn't work with any other agency. I had to be, in order to get everything what we needed, because we had so many agencies involved, I needed to be the one in charge of the independent investigation, period. It's not an ego thing. It's just the way it had to be in that particular case. Next thing I know, you know, a few weeks into it, some guy on a talk blog or some private investigator out of Florida is coming into all the chat rooms saying that he's going to that him and his team are looking forward to taking over the case. And when I confronted Billy about it, she said that she didn't think that another set of eyes, she'll take any help she can get. And I said, I understand where you're coming from as a grieving parent, but that wasn't part of the deal. I said, the deal was I'm in charge of the independent investigation. It has to be that way. And then that's when I started being accused of letting my ego get in the way of finding a little girl. So at that point, that's when I just called it quits completely.
Okay. Kim, do you have questions from the chat room you want to?
Yes, I do. Thank you so much. This is from Boston Lady. Hi. Can Peter ask Mac if Mac checked with law enforcement to see if what Billy said about the polygraph to him was true?
No, I never followed up. I never got that far into it because, again, at that point, I wasn't looking for who did it. I was looking for the child. And so these are just things that I picked up along the way. That gave me the ammo to defend her if I had to. So I was never actually hired by Billy. I was asked to help, and I accepted
mm-hmm.
help there. But I never did follow up with law enforcement on that.
Okay, Mac, what was your defense of Billy? I'm kind of curious about that.
Was my what?
What was your defense of her? Like what caused you to defend her?
Well, the main thing was that I was trying to give her the benefit of the doubt. You know, it's heinous to believe that she had something to do with it. You know, and if she honestly didn't have anything to do with it, I couldn't imagine that feeling, begging for help and nobody believing that you did that. You know, everybody thinking that you did it. You know, like I said, I needed to be more analytical. I needed to remove myself more emotionally from it. I made that mistake. My defense for her was, hey, look, she was fed answers on the lie detector. She's been forthcoming. She's been trying to get people to help. Adkins is the one that did it. You know, she believed all along that Adkins is the one that did it.
Was your defense of her, because I want to limit you here, was your defense of her basically that Adkins had did it?
Yes, that okay. She had let this monster into her home.
Right. And did she have any contact with him while you were investigating this monster?
None at all. At one point, he didn't even have a phone, and nobody
right,
even
but,
knew where he lived.
Right. How is it that he refused to cooperate with you if he had no contact at all?
Well, I'd sent him several emails, messages. I had several people that they were mutual friends with try to get him the message, hey, you know, Mac wants to talk to you. Mac wants to interview you. Nothing to no avail.
And about Billy? What was her response to that?
Well, Billy said basically it was par for the course. You know, that was her stance on it was, you know, you don't expect to get anything from him. At the time that Haley went missing, allegedly, according to Billy, they were broken up anyway.
Did you
she
believe that, though?
Yes and no. I could understand, that's one of those things that can be looked at from either direction, from either way, and given a different answer from both sides, you know, depending on the point of view, you know,
right,
I mean, that could
be. When she was hiding him in her house and she lied to police, what did you think about that?
Well, the way I was presented that was that, he had shown up without her knowledge and had said, let me take it back. Billy's whole contention was that the district attorney investigator had a crush on her, and that he was adamant that she not talk to Atkins because he was romantically interested in her.
Now, this is Billy Sides?
Yeah, this is... Yes, and
okay.
And that couldn't be further from the truth.
Let me, if I could, Max, address that. Billy's concern was bringing justice for Haley. He's a smart man.
Absolutely.
He would not be duped by her, not by a single sentence, and not by, I think, what I consider just really inappropriate sexualized behavior. As a matter of fact, and I shared this with you via Facebook today, even when Billie Jean runs to insult someone or threaten someone, the language she uses is always a mixture of sexuality and violence. She calls upon body organs when she's angry. She calls upon people to be gang raped, that sort of thing. That's her world. That her world is sexual violence. Did you ever get the insight, and this came from Lillian Glass, Dr. Lillian Glass, that Billie Jean views Haley as a rival? Because she's obviously a narcissist. She's obviously someone who can't empathize with others, and the focus is upon her and her fading sexuality. Dr. Lillian Glass had said she believed that Billie Jean was involved just as much as Sean Atkins was in the murder, and that it was a night that exploded because there was Sean was molesting Haley. They had obviously been showing her pornography. There's drugs in the house. Billy had performed in the pornography herself. There apparently was no bottom. And for those who think that bestiality is a joke, it's sexual abuse of animals where people bring harm and even death to animals and receive a sexual satisfaction from that. So it's not just a funny cartoon that you would like to portray that to be. This is stuff that's rooted in violence, and this is the stuff that was used to desensitize a 13-year-old girl. So I wondered how much of that was evident to you, even in her behavior. You're a private investigator, and she's moving on the dance floor towards you that way. I'd be pretty skeeved out, I got to tell you.
Very much. I didn't even hear anything about that from Lillian Glass. I'd never... that just validifies what I really had thought that myself, and had wondered if there was any molestation on the part of Atkins, and how not just molestation, but instead of Billy going into defense mode of her daughter, more of an accusatory mode of you're seducing my boyfriend.
Oh, sure. That's what Dr. Glass's point was. Hey, we're going to stay.
Yeah.
We lose our lives, but we'll stay on for the next 15 minutes. You'll hear it on the recording later, listeners.
Yes. Yes.
Mac, before we lose the first live listeners, was there another mother who contacted you recently that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah. Well, I find it interesting that another mother, the more I started thinking about this, I'm talking as if I have personally verified that this was her calling me, which I haven't. I'm taking the caller at their word that this was her. Okay, so let me CYA on that, okay? what I found very interesting was I was the most hated mother in America had contacted me and had kept referring to it as she'd received my number from following the Billy Dunn case, which I thought was very telling, because I don't know of any human being alive that refers to a missing girl case by the name of the mother, and other than possibly the mother in a very similar situation, who's none other than Casey Anthony herself.
That was a howl, and I can tell you, you can know if it was true or not by the amount of qualifiers she uses in each sentence. That's her method of deception. So say almost probably similar, kind of like, either or. She uses those expressions. Hey, I have a question. In the initial interview with Billie Jean Dunn, did you record the interview?
No, sir, I didn't, and for a number of reasons. For one, I didn't. I didn't want it to make it seem like I was going in there trying to catch her in a lie. I went in there just essentially to get information regarding where to start looking for the girl. It didn't really cross my mind that she was gonna, you know, that she had anything to do with it, that she, you know, so I didn't even bother recording it, which is,
okay,
you know, hindsight, a mistake.
Sure. As a matter of fact, even generally speaking, innocent parents have no objection to being recorded because they want their words heard. They're desperate to be heard. So if they're thinking that it's going to be played back again, some of them will actually ask to have it recorded. And you're right, though. But you know, that Mac, as you're talking, it sounds like you went into it knowing that she was hypersensitive about being accused.
Yes, very much. She had made that pretty clear when she had initially called me. You know, she cried on the phone the first night she talked to me, you know, and you know, like I said, I've always worked these cases on an incredible sense of urgency. You know, let's hit the ground running. Let's find the girl. That's the motive. That's the objective. You know,
I'd like to say this in your defense, but good Mac, it's easy for someone listening to say, you know, wow, how could you not know that she was lying? Just, you know, you're a private investigator. This goes back a number of years where I did my first interview of a child murderer. And she was a mother, and she had beautiful blue eyes, and she was young. She was probably 21. And she spoke softly. And I found myself in an emotional crossroads where I was looking at pictures of the child that she killed. She literally dragged her child up and down stairs, her two-year-old, and split her head open. And I was looking at the crime scene photos on one side, and the other side, seeing this soft, she had actually just given birth to a second child, soft blue-eyed, soft voice, really tugging at me. And I did the interview, completed the interview, went out to my car, opened up the crime scene photos, and I bawled my eyes out just over the humanity and the loss of a little girl's life and how this young woman laying in a hospital bed before me was lying through her teeth because she was desperate to keep this child and she was just so mentally ill. It reminds me of the Billy Dunn case because, like Billy Dunn, this young woman had been a victim of sexual violence growing up. She'd been raped by her father, that sort of thing. Billy Dunn had told one talk radio host that she had been prostituted out as a child. And I believe it to be true because of her language. There are certain indicators within language that show us that. It doesn't justify, and that's what people rush to, hey, don't make excuses. For me, it's not an excuse. For me, the punishment must fit the crime and must be not beyond or not beneath it. It does help us understand these things, and it gives us insight. But realistically, when we're looking for a missing child, every bit of information that comes out of a parent's mouth can be critical for us, guilty or innocent. And had you, in that same vein, had you heard about Sean Atkins saying to the police, you can find her in Scurry County?
No, at that point, no. I hadn't even begun to even look into him at all.
When did your education, the reality of this case, when did it really hit home for you? Like,
it hit home on the ride home after the initial interview, the initial eight-hour interview. I started telling myself that, you know, even if she did it, you know, because I had these initial, you know, reservations at the beginning, and I said to myself, even if she did it, you know, my job is to find the girl. You know, let's find Haley, deal with who did it later. You know, so for that reason alone, you know, I didn't actually act on a lot of my suspicions until much later.
Was there any point where your suspicions of Billy Dunn herself led you to think, you know, if I get her to talk, maybe I can find the body?
Yes. I several times had thought, man, if I can, you know, maybe gain her trust to tell me, you know, just admit to me and, you know, maybe tell her I can help get her out of it or, you know, whatever. But you know, she's a smart girl. You know, don't let her, you know, her apocryphy fool you on her interviews. I mean, she's used to getting her way.
Yeah, I think that she's a survivor. It's another actual reason I believe that she was molested in childhood and prostituted out, as she said, because she is smart. She butchers the English language, and people see that. They think that that's not intelligence. No, she just doesn't have training in grammar and English, and she does butcher it. However, she knows how to lie, and you put it this way, to get her way. Liars, those who fabricate reality, hold the world in contempt. They believe they're smarter than others. They have an expectation of getting away with it. They're Mark Redwine walking on the stage of Dr. Phil's show. They're Casey Anthony walking down the hallway at Universal, thinking to themselves, I will get myself out of this one way or another. And that was the pattern that Billie Jean showed. Even going on Nancy Grace's show, she got smoked really badly. And then she failed the polygraphs. She ended up blaming the polygrapher. She blamed her toothache. She blamed them for taking away her faith in the polygraph itself. And what she did was very cleverly is change the argument. So I agree with you. She should not be underestimated. The key for me in this case is that Billie Jean Dunn was the brains of the operation. She had called Sean at one point MR, MHMR, she called it, mental retardation, to Nancy Grace. And she wasn't making fun of him. She was actually saying that, you know, he has some real problems. But she was the orchestrator of the story about the 3 o'clock thing that she had read online. Did you ever put that together?
No.
Okay, that was what had happened was Nancy Grace had pointed out that the story sounded an awful lot like another girl's story. Can you get the name of that story for me, the other victim? And when it was revealed that they had all this vile video in their home, Billie Jean went to memory, which she went right to her memory, and she said, I have serial killers and true crime stories that I got from your library, Nancy Grace. I think it was truecrimelibrary.org, one of those, like an address was like that was associated with Nancy Grace. Carly Brucia case, where a young girl who went out in the afternoon to go to a friend's house, she never made it, she was found murdered. Well, Billie Jean had downloaded that story from the internet, from her job, printed it out. When she went on the show and when she went to the police, she actually used that story. And this is why people's words are so important. If I were, Mac, if I were to ask you to tell a lie and just tell a story that's really false from childhood, and people would try to discern if it's true or not, the difficulty is that you're going to tell us something from some form of memory. It could be a book that was read or a friend's story, but it doesn't come from a vacuum. None of our words do. So when Billie Jean was telling the story about how she was going over to a little friend's sleepover, which she wasn't, there was never any such plan and never any such phone call, when she was telling the story, she was literally lifting it from a download from Nancy Grace's library that Nancy Grace recognized. So when Sean Atkins started to talk about it, what he did was he entered into Billie Jean's language. That showed us that Billie Jean was the one who orchestrated the story. She was the brains of the operation. So I think that what had happened was that Haley was being molested by Sean, and there was drugs involved, and they had been desensitizing her through the pornography and the killer videos and all that other stuff. And Billie Jean lost it in some kind of drug haze, and they were unable to resuscitate her that night in bed. And so that's when Billie Jean gave the description where she's actually describing a dead body in the bedroom where it looked like her laying there, but she never checked on her. And Nancy Grace picked up on that and said to her, well, okay, when was the last time you saw her? She's like, well, Sunday night. So I think that we're looking at a case that many of us have been just crying out for justice to the prosecutors, and maybe we're getting closer. Maybe the forensics will yield something. But they had 109,000 deviant images. What did Billie Jean say to that?
Now, according to her defense to that was that all of those consisted of thousands and thousands of pop-up ads that were blocked on the, you know, from the normal, she openly admits to looking at porn and making porn and, you know, with Adkins and you know, being heavily involved in it, and, you know, not for commercial that I know of, but, you know, between the two of them and looking at it and everything. So she claimed all those were blocked images that the pop-up blocker had blocked, but were still a part of the hard drive. And,
yeah, how many? I've been on the internet for 20 years. I've never seen child pornography, and I've never had a blocker block it either. It has to be sorted out. Hey, I have to ask you a question before we go because we're getting time.
Yeah.
The question is, did Billie Jean ever seem to you, and this would just be your opinion, confident that she was going to get away with it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Almost to the point where, you know, she convinced herself that she is nothing less than a grieving mother.
Wow.
You know, that's a victim of, you know, bringing the wrong guy around her kid. And,
here's another question for you. Did you ever interview David?
No, David, I don't know if this is pop public knowledge of this, but he's not the same father. He's not from the same father as Haley. He's from a dad that he doesn't know. Okay. He's a hardworking kid. Every time I was there, he was usually at work. I didn't have much interaction with him, but you know, I never thought him to be, you know, he seemed to really try to take care of his mom. When she wasn't employed, he gave her his whole paycheck, you know, to support her. You know, I didn't have enough interaction with him to really form any other opinion of him other than he seemed like a great kid because he was, you know, so supported his mom so diligently.
Okay. The accusations, other question, the accusations that you had slept with Billie and it was inappropriate, did that hurt your business?
No, not at all. Not at all. But, you know, it's just something I deal with constantly. And I'm a very gregarious guy. You know, anybody that knows me knows I'm, you know, I have the mouth of a sailor anyway. So, you know, I'm the first to admit it. But no, it didn't affect it at all. You know, it's come up a few times, you know, like, people have asked me about it that I've met that did, you know, clients of mine that knew about the case and then read about it and then later confronted me saying, oh my gosh, did you sleep with this girl? But, you know, other than that, no, it didn't. It hasn't turned any business down or, you know, detracted anybody from using my services that I know of.
Yep. Did it affect your personal life at all?
No, not really. Not at all. My personal life is my work. You know, I mean, I work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, one thing I wanted to add too about the pornography being readily available to the children to view. The pornography was the videos that she made with Sean Atkins and another female were actually kept stored on the Xbox. That
wow.
the same Xbox as the children played with. You know,
wow.
Played video games on. So it was very easily, readily seen.
Mac, that's not something that I think any of us knew. At least I did not know about that. Kim, have you ever heard of that before?
No, I have not at all. That is.
It's out there. But I guess it shouldn't surprise us, and it doesn't speak well for me to be surprised by it. But, Mac, was there other things that were inside the case that you think the public just had no clue as? Like the public would be surprised about?
Yeah, yes and no. The public has picked apart this case to extreme minutia to the point where they're arguing online over what color earrings Haley had the day before she went missing. And they're arguing about the description of the clothes she was wearing as it being a green stripe instead of a blue stripe. On the sweatpants.
Did you have contact with Clint Dunn and Naomi?
Yeah, not Naomi. Naomi initially, I had suspected that Naomi's mother might have had something to do with it. You know, there was motive, there was opportunity, so I really explored that and came up really empty-handed on it. You know, just trying. You know, I was kind of in denial that it could be that easy, but when it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, I mean, it's right there in front of your face, you know?
Did Billie give you Did you, at any time when she gave you this list of people, did you ever stop to really consider this as a tangent and a distraction from the case?
You know, I resented the hell out of that because later on, after I had invested literally hundreds of hours into this, I really began to get angry at the fact that, you know, I'm doing it pro bono. I'm coming out of pocket on this. I'm turning down, you know, lucrative other cases so that I can focus on this. And it really got to me after a while. And then I started to realize it's just, you know, that's part of the course on this, you know, on her behavior. I mean, that's indicative of her past behavior, you know, manipulation and denial and use, you know, complete use of someone, you know.
Do you think that she sensed that you were onto her?
I don't think so. I think she thought that all along that she had me wrapped around her finger, and that, you know, she could lure me along with her, you know, with her looks and her charm.
Does she believe that she is like a manipulator of men? Does she see a different person in the mirror than other people see?
Yeah, I think she knows she is. But you got to get to know her to know that she knows that.
What about her and John Young?
Actually, John Young is a character. I didn't have a problem with him. I reported to him with all my other findings, and he was very astute. He listened, you know. He was very interested in other ideas, in other suspects, and you know, was very
open.
You know, he's a very, very well connected attorney in that part of the state. You know, and I can't say if I weren't, you know, he's you know, best stated the Teflon attorney. You know, if I were accused of a crime that I didn't commit, I can't say I wouldn't want him on my side. You know, he's got a great track record.
What do you say to the people that say that the regime was having an affair with him?
I don't know. I wouldn't know. She would deny that, I'm sure, but and I don't know anything of it firsthand. I'm sure the assumptions are out there. There's has to be motivation and reason why someone would take the case pro bono, you know, a case like that pro bono, you know, but in his case, you know, it comes back to he would take it just, you know, for publicity and for, you know, to get his name out there in the press, I'm sure, in a positive light.
I wonder if you saw the manipulative behaviors that she exhibited towards you, other men in general, and including John Young.
I think those two played off of each other with it. I mean, you know, he constantly was blowing smoke up my butt, and you know, I sometimes just wanted to say, hey, man, you know, you don't have to make me feel like I'm Telly Savalas here. It was almost over the top complimentary, you know, which, you know, I'm not coming up with groundbreaking evidence that's that far fetched. So
beware the flatterer.
You know, very much so. But you know, like I said, he's got a great track record, man. As far as defense attorneys go, he's the guy you want on your side if you're accused, you know, especially in that part of the state.
Kim, you were going to go?
I'm sorry, me? I didn't catch that.
I think that Kim, we're out of time.
Yes,
oh, okay.
We are. We are out of time, and let me just wrap this up by saying, thank you, Max, so much for being here. It was great having you. Thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Thank you, Peter, so much, and thank you, Mac.
Thank you, Mac.
Thank you, Peter.
Good night. And thank you, everybody in the chat room. You guys are great. Good night.